So this week, the theme is the point of no return. So I'll say a bit about what that actually is in a bit. But, and when I was thinking of this theme, for some reason my mind kept turning to Shakespeare and specifically Hamlet. I don't know if that's because, we're celebrating 400 years of Shakespeare's birth, isn't it, this year? So there's lots of stuff in the media around it. So I think somewhere that's just sort of seeped into my sort of mind, and I sort of couldn't get sort of Hamlet out of my mind. So you're going to have a little bit of a recap of Hamlet, and hopefully it'll get us to the point of no return. So we're familiar, hopefully we're all familiar with the story. So Hamlet is this prince. He's a very learned man. We kind of get that sense straight away that he's learned, he's a fine man, and it really has a lot of potential as the king, as a future king. But we encounter him in crisis, because he's just, well, his father's died, sudden death of his father, and his world is shattered by this. It's almost like the light goes out of his life from the death of his father. So he's really confronted by impermanence, and not only that, his mother, who, his beloved mother, the noble queen, suddenly remarries, quickly remarries, and his uncle as well. And his mother, who he respected as this noble woman, he suddenly sees her in a very different light. He sees that she's succumbed to her desires and succumbed to the need for security, and has sought security in the arms of his uncle, and he can't bear that. So that's the other earthquake that goes off in his life, if you like. So, and as if that wasn't enough, he then, I don't know which order this happens in, so some of you will know this well, but I know he has this apparition of his father's ghost, of his father, and he's it's saying that, well, I died at the hands of your uncle. So not only was there this sudden death of his father, foul play is potentially at hand, and his uncle stands accused. So it's tragedy upon tragedy, really, and his world has fallen apart. And well, he kind of feels that he has to avenge his father. It's sort of almost a custom of the day, probably as well. But also his rage that he feels and that sense of injustice sort of dictates really that that's what he needs to do. But because he's got this mind that's very fine and very sensitive and intelligent. He's really caught in this, sort of real struggle. Because he really wants to understand. He really wants to understand why, his mother's done what she's done. Why, his father's died. He really just wants to understand what's happened. He really sort of really wants to understand impermanence and instability and uncertainty. So he really battles, doesn't he? He battles with these raw emotions of anger and hatred, and at the same time, he's got this desire to know and to understand the situation more clearly. And I remember when I first read it, I really wanted him to know the truth of what happened. And I wanted him to sort of speak the truth out. I wanted him to let people know what had happened, or at least share his understanding with everybody. And at the same time, I didn't want him to succumb to his emotions. I wanted him to survive the experience. So I wanted him to sort of somehow change the scenario where he was and keep himself well, really. I wanted him to become the great king that I felt he could be. But of course, it doesn't work out like that, does it? It ends in this terrible tragedy, and it's interesting that we enact this tragedy sort of all over the world, to this day. So, And then I realised, oh, actually, there's a few similarities, I think, between Hamlet and Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha to be. So, what are these? So, firstly, they're both born into noble families, and they're both destined to be kings, great kings. You get the sense as well from Siddhartha that he's intelligent, he's educated, he's a fine mind too. So, they both share that as well. And then, of course, the other big similarity is that their worlds are shattered by impermanence. So, with Siddhartha, it's him going out, seeing the old person, the sick person, and the dead person. And that is enough for him. Well, he really sees it. It's not just like it's just there. He really sees the truth of that. And he knows what he sees is going to happen to him. And not just to him, but to all the people he loves. And they both have this melancholic time. So some of the reports of Siddhartha is that he goes back to the palace, but he's just not the same, and everyone starts worrying about him, like what's he doing? You know, he's just not interacting, in the way that he normally does. So they both have this really sort of melancholic time. And then looking at their current lives with despair. Obviously, Hamlet is kind of traumatized really by his experience, but he sees the superficiality of how things are. It's almost like what people around him can't see what he's seen, and they're carrying on with life as normal, and he can't bear that, he can't understand that. And the same with Siddhartha. He's like, doesn't everybody know what's going to be happening? And they're carrying on dancing and carrying on having fun. How can they do that? So neither of them can relate to their current experience in the same way. So I think probably that's the comparisons, the similarities that I was thinking of. And it may end there because obviously with Siddhartha, he sees, he's got a way out of this crisis, isn't he? Because on his final visit out of the palace, if you take the traditional sort of accounts, as how it was, he goes out the palace and he's still in crisis, but he sees this wandering mendicant who's walking through the city very serene. And he's thinking, he must know something that I don't yet know. So he's got this way out. Hamlet doesn't, does he? We just see him continually wrestling between, his emotions, his sense of injustice, and, trying to understand more clearly what's happened. So unlike Siddhartha, he goes off on this quest for freedom, and Hamlet is just caught in this ongoing struggle. Really, it's a battleground, isn't it? I mean, that's what Hamlet represents. He represents this sort of battleground between the forces of that want to grow and understand and learn and overcome, and the forces that want to destroy or are confused or want to act blindly. That's what he kind of represents. And in a way, that's the sort of I think we probably relate to Hamlet, even though his circumstances are quite extreme on one level. I think there's something that we relate to, which is why, it's one of the most popular plays, because that sort of struggle we see going on in different ways at different times in our lives, but also certainly in the lives, picking up the newspaper, you see that struggle, pretty much every day. So that sort of pull, so we have these two pulls within our being. We have the sort of pull towards and sort of movement upwards, really. That wants to grow, wants to learn, and we have this other pull that wants us to stay where we are, that wants us to remain, unaware, that wants us to just destroy as well sometimes. That's what that other pull does. So Bhante, Sangharakshita, calls this the gravitational pull. And this kind of pull backwards is a gravitational pull of the conditioned. So that, and that's the sort of constant oscillation that we have between hope, fear, pain, loss, gain, pain, pleasure. We have this constant oscillation going on, and not sort of no real movement going forwards. And that's the sort of gravitational pull of the conditioned. So, and he says this operates in all aspects of our lives and throughout history. So I think we can see that because, you know, just from like if you decide, right, I'm going to get, you know, fit and healthy and you think, right, tomorrow I'm going to, you know, exercise. And then you do, you know, exercise and you feel great, you know, you feel fantastic because you've set out on something and you've achieved it and you feel really good. It's like a movement forward. And then the next day you're like, why am I going? I don't really need to go. Why do you start sort of having that conversation in your head and you sort of undermine the very sort of intention that you'd set, you know, previously. And then maybe you don't go out exercising and you feel afterwards like, I really should have gone, you know. And it's just that, and on a very little way, we have it going on sort of pretty much all the time. So yes, and then you see it in a big way. As you said, if you pick up the newspaper, you see it. If you look through history, in terms of the big events in history, the wars, I was thinking about, you know, how, well, genocide, you know, you see, well, that's where sort of the forces, the destructive forces have just taken over and there just isn't enough sort of collective will, if you like, for sort of growth and for healing and love going on there. So it's this gravitational pull is there all the time, and we find ourselves in conflict a lot of the time, those opposing forces in little ways and in big ways. So Siddhartha, the Buddha to be, he's this, you know, sees this wandering mendicant, and it gives him the clue that there must be a way out of this sort of very human struggle. And it made me think then, I thought, well, what if Hamlet had access to metta bhavana and mindfulness in the midst of his struggle? What would have happened? So, any ideas? What would his experience been? And assume that he's got a teacher, a skilled teacher, who's not just doing it off online or something. You know, he's kind of, he's got somebody doing it with him. What would have he encountered? Yeah. Straight away?
No, I think we would have had to practice for a little while.
Yeah. So eventually some kind of refuge from it, but to begin with, what do you think would have...
He would have become aware of his own confusion.
Yeah. He would have, rather than just being in it, he would have sort of stepped back and seen his confusion. Yeah. Anything else? You might have forgiven his mum, straight off. I think for me, I think he probably would have had to experience his emotions very sort of fully, first off, probably. You know, and that's one of the things, isn't it, that when we in difficult states or we're distressed or unhappy, it's actually sometimes quite hard for us just to sit, because we kind of, you know, need to face it, don't we? We sort of have to look at it. We can't sort of avoid it through activity or through a discussion. It's like we have to just sort of, this is what's going on. I'm confused. I'm angry. I don't understand my mother. And then what? Then what happens? In a way, it's kind of that you can only stay there if you practice for a certain amount of time. And then it shifts, doesn't it? It shifts into something else. Doesn't mean it goes away, you know, automatically, but it certainly changes. His experience of his rage would have changed. He would have got more familiar with it, at least. And hopefully, eventually, he might have... I think some of it would have calmed just from sitting with it. It might not have had that same level of intensity over time. And I think he may have then began to reflect on his behaviour as well. Because when he's in this sort of states of rage, he's just acting and coming up with all these ideas of what he can do. But actually, if he was sitting with it, he probably would have begun to think a bit more clearly about, okay, what is the better thing for me to do in the situation I'm in? Yeah? So ethics would have hopefully begun to sort of come into it. So any, and what sort of teachings do you think would have been, might have struck him or would have been really useful for him to think about? Okay.
Because part of the reason that he feels that he has to avenge his father is because of the societal expectation.
Yeah, yeah.
As well as his own rage and his own impetus.
Yeah.
So becoming aware of his own personal conditioning as part of a greater conditioning.
Yeah, yeah.
Can help to detangle exactly what's going on.
Yeah. He would have seen that some of his responses may have been conditioned by, yeah, as you say, societal expectations. So the law of conditionality certainly would have might have come in there in lots of different ways. Yeah. Any others?
I suppose the teaching of impermanence.
Yeah.
And the idea that actually his anger and his rage aren't fixed.
Okay.
Kind of feelings. They
right.
Won't abate. They
yes.
Won't move forward.
Which he might have had when he just did the meditation as well. He would have seen the sort of energy move. So in that sense. But also the teaching of impermanence in a sense of, you know, the loss he experienced and realising that he's not alone in experiencing loss, perhaps. Yeah.
The idea of the two arrows.
Mm.
And the story of the samurai, the old man,
yeah.
If he takes out his sword to fight back, he finds himself back in hell.
Yes.
But maybe if he finds a way to not pick up the sword, he can find a way out of it.
Absolutely, that's great. So, you know, the teaching of the two arrows, the first arrow is the experience, the pain. The second arrow is what we then bring to it. And he would have realised that he was bringing a lot to this, that, and actually it was almost stopping him from actually experiencing the grief that he was in. Yeah. Did you have? You can say the same thing. Yeah, great. So that's good. Your Dharma knowledge is it's good. So it kind of made me think of another story with in another sort of crisis in the Buddha's scriptures, of a very well-known story of Kisagotami. That's a really interesting story, because here's a woman who's she's married in a well-to-do family, apparently, but she has a really low status. And Kisagotami means skinny Gotami. So I think somehow like she's had lots of derogatory comments about herself over time. And you get this sense of this woman who hasn't got much of a voice, who hasn't got much confidence, and she's not treated that well by her family, and she's not given much love by her husband. And then she has a child, she has a baby, and suddenly a boy, and suddenly she's somebody. She's really, you know, people really rejoicing her, and she feels that she now has a sort of identity. She has a role in the family, status in the family. But then, of course, tragedy strikes and her son dies. And she's completely distraught. In fact, it destabilizes her, and she's sort of mad with grief, really. And she walks around with the child on her hip, the dead child on her hip, and asking people for medicine. And obviously most people are just like, you know, can see that she's just lost her mind and, you know, avoid her or, you know, all the usual. But there's one person that directs her to the Buddha, so that he can help you. So she goes off to the Buddha, and you can imagine that the Buddha, seeing this woman approach him with this, you know, dead child, on her hips, and you can imagine that he's already thinking that an ordinary teaching is not going to help. You know, him talking about impermanence is not going to get through. So she comes and she says, you know, can you give me some medicine for my child? And he says, you know, go to a house and get a mustard seed. And she's like, great, you know, that's all I've got to do is find a mustard seed. They're very cheap. You know, people give me mustard seeds. But it has to come from a house where no one has died. So she goes off and knocks on the houses. And, you know, you can imagine they sort of look at her and go, yeah, of course I've got a mustard seed. And then she says to them, but nobody must have died. And then some of them say very matter-of-factly, of course people have died here, of course. And others may be freshly, you know, bereaved and, you know, tears in their eyes, saying, well, yeah, I've lost somebody recently. So from house to house she goes. And you can imagine at first she's really frustrated. She just wants to get a mustard seed from a house where no one's died. And then she hears a story after story, and probably gets to a point of despair, I imagine, because she's not finding this mustard seed. But then she carries on hearing these stories of loss, and it just gradually dawns on her that, oh, this is how things are. And yeah, the experience she has is very profound. It's basically it touches all of her being, if you like, the realization that loss, impermanence, is everywhere, and she eventually lays her child down to rest and goes to the Buddha, and says that the work of the mustard seed has been done. And it's so profound that you know from the story that she's not going to go back to how things were. She can't go back to how things were. She can't unsee what she's seen. She can't unknow, you know, the truth that sort of occurred to her, that's really sort of caught her. It's had such an impact on her that she goes to the Buddha and goes to refuge to him in a very real way. So there's no doubt. When she goes to refuge with the Buddha, she absolutely knows that he's had a realization of enlightenment. When she goes to refuge with the Buddha, she knows that the teachings he's teaching will also get her there. She knows that the Sangha that she's going to be part of is also on that journey too. And she has total confidence in the teachings. She knows that, like her child, you know, she has come into existence on dependence upon conditions, and she will cease to be on dependence upon conditions, just like her child. She absolutely knows that. And her identity as a mother, you know, which has meant so much to her, she can leave behind. In fact, she knows she can let go of all the roles that she would have had, because she knows that they're also dependent on conditions. She knows that they're not going to give her the security that she really seeks. So she goes to refuge with the Buddha, and she's not yet enlightened at that point, but she has reached the point of no return. She's not going to rely on dependence on that which is unstable or inherently, you know, constantly changing. She's not going to rely on that anymore. And she's gradually, but definitely, going to release herself from all that holds her back from freedom. So that resistance, that sort of battle that I was talking about between the forces of growth and the forces that hold you back, that sort of resistance that goes, that struggle, she doesn't have in the same way anymore. She's still pulled, there is a force at work for her, but it's the force of the unconditioned. It's a force of freedom, if you like. It's a force of truth. It's a force of love. It's a force of beauty. That is what she's aligned with now. And that's the thing that's sort of pulling her along more than the force pulling her back. So so a metaphor that's kind of used is of the enlightenment, nirvana, as the great ocean. So that's the great ocean is freedom. And then you have this stream that, you know, takes you there. That sort of, you know, you enter the stream and it leads to the ocean. So another word for the point of no return, if you've reached the point of no return, then another term is that you'll become a stream entrant. You know, you've entered the stream that's going to take you all the way eventually to enlightenment. It's assured, in fact. So if the nirvana is, so you've got the ocean and you've got, is this a different metaphor? I'm not sure. I'm going to use a few different metaphors at the moment. So you've got the shore, where we are now, conditioned existence. And then we've got the other shore, which is the unconditioned nirvana. And we want to get from one to the other. That's one way of looking at it. It's not the only way of looking at it, but it's one way of looking at it. And so we need to find a way to get there. And the Dharma is the raft. Yeah. So you may have heard the parable of the raft, which is where we're here, we want to get over there, we need a vehicle, we need a way to get there. And the Dharma is that. So we get on the raft and we have to make quite a bit of effort. We have to sit in meditation. We practice ethics. We study the teachings. We're basically constantly needing to make effort because we have this pull, this gravitational pull that's pulling us in the other direction if we don't make the effort. And you can imagine it's like the water, the stream, the currents is moving that way and we want to go that way. So basically, if we don't keep making the effort, we basically go backwards or we drift. Yeah. So that's the kind of parable of the raft. And we have to keep making effort. And when you're a stream entrant, you get to the point where you don't have to make effort anymore, which I think is great. You don't have to make the same kind of effort because the current is now moving with you. Yeah. So the forces of good, the forces of positivity, you're moving with it. Eventually you become it, but you're certainly moving with it and it's moving with you. So there's not that sort of resistance in the same way. I'll just pause there because I'm going to go, I'll talk a bit about how we know that's happened. But any questions before I do that? Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha to be.
I mean, because isn't there sort of a space for reasoning that the social injustice needed to be corrected somehow?
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like Claudius would probably have been quite a tyrannical
one. Yeah.
Who kind of might have needed to be taken out. It seems to me that the play, he struggles between the idea of acting and not acting,
yes,
he decides to act. For the greater good as much as his own personal good.
So with awareness and with sort of understanding of conditionality, that things arise in dependence on condition, what do we think would have been... I mean, it's one of those difficulties, isn't it? Because we see that in the newspaper, the news all the time. There's these conflicts and there's not easy answers, are there, in terms of how you resolve them. But we can bring an understanding of ethics to it, and we can bring an understanding of conditionality to it. So although we can't resolve the whole play, like what would have happened, we can think, well, what would have been some good next steps, some good conditions to things to set up that would have at least not made things worse? Any ideas? No, that's kind of like leaping, sort of, you know. I mean, personally, I think what he wasn't able to do, Hamlet, was just speak his experience sort of clearly, you know, because he was sort of so conflicted and so sort of enraged. He wasn't able to sort of just articulate that. Who knows what would have happened if he'd have managed to find some sort of good counsel with others and, you know, expressed his concerns. I don't know. But certainly we know that he wasn't able to, he was sort of driven by his emotions and his confusion. That's what we know. And we don't know what would have happened if he'd have brought some awareness to it. And in a way, you can think about your own conflicts. You know, what happens when you bring, you know, you can be in a conflict and act from your the negativity that you have. And you can be in a conflict, step back from it and figure out, well, what is the most skillful thing to do? And how much is my perception coloured by my emotions? Yeah. And that changes things. Any other questions? You ready to find out about the fetters then? Okay. How we get to this, how we know that to get, how do we get to that point of no return? So there's two basic ways. One is a sort of positive way, and one is more about sort of getting, you know, letting go of things. So there's a kind of moving towards and a letting go of. So we're probably going to have a talk on it at some point. But one is the spiral path, which is basically, you know, cultivating positive emotions and building on those emotions to the point where you can begin to bring in some wisdom. So for example, it goes from suffering. So you have an experience of suffering, and then that leads to faith. And then you have an experience of faith, and that leads to joy. And basically, rather than the oscillation that we have between pain and pleasure, each positive emotion builds on the next. The problem, not so much with a spiral path, but why wisdom needs to come in is because positive emotion is not enough. The Buddha to be had that experience. When he was off on his search, he sort of found these great teachers who could teach him, you know, amazing meditation techniques and showed him really how to reach higher states of consciousness. And so the stories say that, you know, he really excelled at that and became as good, if not better, than his teachers. And in the end, they said, well, come and join us, you know, because you've surpassed us in your understanding of meditation. But the Buddha-to-be, Siddhartha, knew that he would get to these exalted states and then the meditation would finish and he would basically, you know, go back to where he was previously. So he would keep having these great experiences, but he would also fall back. And that was, again, that sort of gravitational pull. And we've probably all had experiences like that, probably, you know, where you, you know, you've done Metta Bhavana or something and you feel really great. And you think, I feel now, from now on, I'm just going to be a lot kinder, you know, to everybody. And then the next thing you know, you're kind of really deeply irritated by somebody and your Metta Bhavana that you had only a few moments ago is just gone. And a classic is going on retreat. You know, I mean, we encourage everyone to go on retreat. At the same time, sometimes, you know, your experience is so positive on retreat. And you do think that's going to carry me through. And something does carry through, absolutely. But coming back from retreat can be quite difficult. You can find yourself, because, you know, you're seeing things differently, you're experiencing yourself differently. It can be uncomfortable coming back off retreat sometimes. And then again, you think, gosh, what happened to all those wonderful experiences I had just a few moments ago? So that constant sort of, like, we grow, we develop, we evolve, and there's always the falling back that can happen. Because our growth is also dependent on the conditions. So you're going on retreat, you set up a meditation practice, you have great communication, all of that is supporting your evolution. But if those conditions change, which they will change, then that can affect how we are. So the Buddha kind of knew that, the Buddha-to-be knew that, and he thought he needs to find a way that almost seals that learning, really, that, you know, there's not that falling back that happens. So the spiral path is that sort of path of positive emotions, and then you need to get to that point where wisdom comes in. So that's one way, and we will probably talk more about that another time. And the other way is the fetters. So a fetter is something that restrains or constricts. It said we need to remove. There's 10 fetters that keep us sort of bound, if you like, by sort of the conditionality that keeps us this gravitational pull always there, basically. So Kissa Gotami, there's 10 of them. So if you break all 10, then you're fully enlightened. She didn't break all 10, she broke the first 3. So she was a stream entrant. She had reached that point of no return. So I'll tell you the first 3 fetters. So the first is seeing through the fixed self. So, and again, you don't just see it intellectually. So intellectually you can think, well, you know I'm dependent on conditions. I've kind of come into being on dependent on conditions. So you can sort of say that to yourself, but to then experience it is a very radical happening, because you're no longer experiencing yourself as separate from others. You're seeing others in that way. You're no longer seeing that sort of separation that we always have. So that's the seeing through the fixed self. Second one is doubt. So here, like Kissa Gotami, she absolutely knew that the enlightenment was real. She absolutely knew that the truth of impermanence. She absolutely knew the teachings would take her to freedom. So she had no doubt. So if you think back to the kind of raft, so we've got the kind of shore here where we are and the other shore, and then we have this dharma, the raft taking us from one to the other. If you think of that raft, then what does doubt look like if you're on that raft?
That there's no other shore?
Yeah, you might think, well, I really don't think it exists, actually. I've been on this raft for a while. I really can't see it. Yeah.
Well, an anchor that you're pulling behind you.
Yeah. You've got an anchor. You say, you know what, I do want to get there, but actually I know what this is and I just don't want to lose where I am here. Yeah. Could never move forward, can you?
Maybe the other shore isn't so bad after
all. Yes. What's wrong with this shore? You know, it's not so bad, actually. Yeah. Yeah, because you've got this current, right? You've got the current moving in the other direction, and being on that raft may sometimes feel really choppy. And actually, you know, do you want to? Is it going to get easier? Is it going to get choppier? There might actually be times when the current is really strong, and we're having to work quite hard, and we're not sure at that point. Yeah.
Doubt in your inability to navigate.
Yeah. Yeah. Like other people can do it, you can see other people maybe doing it, but who am I? You know, who am I to really take this great journey because I'm just X, Y, and Z? Yeah. That's all doubt. And it's something that we work with until we get to that point of no return. So the other one is, of course, if you've freed yourself from doubt, then it's kind of plain sailing, isn't it? You're on the raft, you're still having to make some effort, but I can imagine just a sense of ease, because you just know where you're going. There's no sort of stress in the same kind of way. There's no real resistance. You're confident of where it's heading. And the third one is dependence on rites and rituals. And sometimes also said superficiality. So this kind of can manifest as sort of a literal mindedness, really, or complacency. That's kind of how I see it. So it's kind of like, well, I meditate, I do a bit of study, I see some friends, and I come to centre, I go on retreat occasionally. That's going to get me there. You know, doing the external activities will get me there. And it can also be like, really sort of focused on the raft itself, you know, so it's got to look like this, you know, my practice has to look like this, otherwise it's not going to work. So you get fixated like, well, I've got to sit like this, and I've got to go on these kind of retreats, and I've got to talk to these kind of people, and suddenly you have a view as to what, you know, what sort of truth, if you like, or what it looks like. You've just got a view about the whole thing, and that restricts you, in fact, from actually being aware of what you need. So that's kind of superficiality or dependence on rites and rituals. And then, of course, if we're doing that, we're not actually noticing the real opportunities for freedom, are we? We're kind of stuck with habit, basically. We're kind of in certain habits, stuck with them, and assuming, hoping that it's going to get us there. So that's that. So those are the three fetters. Any sort of questions on those? Do you recognise them in your experience? Bhante Sangharaksha says that if we have a relatively healthy mind, if we practice consistently over time with enough sort of intensity, if we've got people around us also doing the same, stream entry is within reach of every single person, every single Buddhist, committed Buddhist. And I find that very sort of, you know, inspiring and reassuring, and I believe that's true. So, and I think it's important to remember that although we've talked about this journey, this shore, that shore, the raft, the decision to want, desire, if you like, to enter the stream, to reach that point of no return, happens at each moment. Because in each moment, there is this choice between those forces that within us. Yeah, there's that sort of gravitational pull between, you know, the conditioned and the unconditioned, between reactivity and creativity, between positivity and negativity. It's going on all the time. So that sort of decision to kind of, this is where I want to go, that sort of choice to go in that direction happens in the moment. And I think, I see this when I do yoga occasionally, when I do yoga, that sometimes I find, sometimes I really enjoy it, and other times I think, why am I here? So hard. And then I remember that actually, I might be there for flexibility and all that, but actually I'm there because it helps exercise in my mind. The more we can find opportunities to work with our resistance, to get used to it's like working with those sort of poles, you know. So in yoga, I'm sort of like, I want to do that. I'm there. I've chosen to be there. I want to do it. And yet there's a bit of me that says, why am I doing it? This is a bit painful. It's not as fun as I would like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I then have to work with those forces. And finding that point of freedom in that is really liberating. So in a way, it's like just accustoming ourselves at each moment to do that. And the more we do that, the easier it becomes. The more sort of pliable our mind becomes, the more open, the more able it is to identify those moments, choose those moments, and then sort of go with it. So it's like the, and I think, well, eventually, that sort of the current that we experience, that level of resistance, does ease. You know, it definitely eases. And we begin to sort of experience that sort of another current that's so much more supportive, that's kind of propelling us along, that we just have to follow. And it's the experience is like receiving blessings, because it feels like the it's can feel like it's coming from outside sometimes. You think, oh, hang on a minute, this is suddenly easier, and things happen, and you think, gosh, I feel much more supported than I did. It can feel like you're suddenly receiving blessings, and something is carrying you along. Something is carrying you along. Something quite mysterious is carrying you along. And I also think, in terms of that anchor that you were talking about, you know, we have so many things that we think we can't do without, that sort of identify us, and that we think, well, this is who I am. But I think the more we sort of get used to working with ourselves in this way, the more we can see through our the conditions, and the more we can see through that things are not fixed, the more we let go of the things that we rely on, that actually, can we truly rely on our roles, for example, that Kissa Gotami probably realised, can we really rely on our roles, can we really rely on, seek our highest truth in those things, can we do that? So the more we see that, the less we're going to be tethered to the other shore, the less that anchor is going to be fixed, the more we can let go. And we're not looking back. We're not looking back, because our experience is more and more one of freedom, and less one of insecurity. So there's this kind of momentum that happens, that sort of carries us along. And I think it's like this, the current is working against us, and then it's almost imperceptibly, it begins to change. It begins to change, so it's one that's moving with us. And at first we might think, oh, this is really good, and you're waiting for it to, you know, go back again. This is how I imagine it. You're kind of waiting for the currents to come, and it may come. You may have to be working again. But at some point, it begins to just keep flowing. And you find yourself sort of, well, just in this stream. And it's like a surrendering then, I think. I think it's like a surrendering, because there's nothing to go back to. And I think it's important, it's not like an individual thing either, because I think you're aware, you've seen through the self, you're kind of not going through the motions, there's no more doubt, you're experiencing the fruits of freedom, and that's manifesting as connection, as love, as authenticity. It's manifesting in all these different ways. And that actually enables you to connect in a different way to other people than you might have done. I think it's, for other people, seeing somebody with that level of confidence and clarity, it gives you such sort of inspiration and hope. It's kind of, you know, there's a way out. So the kind of experience is not an individual one. It's one more of, you know, you're kind of in the stream, in a way you've realised that this thing is possible, and you're kind of just through your being, just through your life, sharing that with others. And that is what gives us all then, and those of us who have not yet entered the stream, a sort of confidence that it can happen, and that eventually it will lead to freedom. So yeah, that's all I want to say. Any last questions? No.
Are we encouraged to leave the things, the conditioned things that we go for refuge for?
Yeah.
Or are we encouraged to see the truth behind them and then to enjoy them while we see the truth behind them?
What do you think? So are we encouraged to kind of leave everything behind, or...
Depends on the Buddhist movement, I think.
Does it? Okay.
Because you got monasteries where they leave
Oh, yeah, right.
In this movement, you don't leave everything behind.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
One side of me wants to think, maybe I should leave everything behind. The other side thinks I'll go crazy.
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. The principle for me is that you don't let go overly prematurely. So in a way, how the practice works, I think, is that you experience say for example, what could it say, a job. You're doing the job, you're enjoying the job. But you get to see over time that it is dependent on conditions, and you get to see over time that your happiness, your ultimate happiness, does not rely just on that job. Yeah. And the more you do that, the more you choose then how you want to respond to it, don't you? You kind of think, well, I still kind of enjoy the job. It's still beneficial. It doesn't define me. That doesn't define my existence. I'm not going to get my ultimate satisfaction from the job. But for now, it's working because of X, Y, and Z. Yeah. And there might be a time as well where you're thinking, actually, that job has really served me well. But now, in order for me to fulfill my this aspiration, I need to let go of that and into something else. When you let go of it, you're not, because you've kind of had that experience, you're not hankering after it. It doesn't feel like a kind of being something torn away from you. You've let go of it quite lightly. Well, sometimes. Yeah, so. Yeah.
In the quote from Sangharakshita, he mentions all people that are health and mind.
Hmm. Good question. I think you do have to be at a certain level of psychological wellness. But that's not to say, because we've talked about two people today, character Hamlet, he was, you know, you could say he was a bit destabilised by what happened, but Kisagotomi certainly was, wasn't she? She was definitely grief-stricken and wasn't seeing things clearly because of that. So you would say in our world, you say, well, she probably was suffering from some kind of mental illness at that point. So it's not to say that if you are, in a way, it's almost like she just needed a different kind of medicine. That's how I see it. I thought at that point she needed a different kind of medicine. She needed the Buddha to give her something quite direct for her to work with things. He wasn't going to give her a teaching in the other kind of way. So I think the Dharma is accessible to everybody. In terms of insight, there needs to be a certain amount of psychological sort of wellness. But at the same time, sometimes if you're in a very strong state and you get the Dharma, it can have a big impact. Okay. Thank you very much.